Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we talk to the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Michel Sabah, as he prepares to retire after 20 years leading the Catholic Church in the Holy Land. And it's no dusty archive. We step inside the Vatican office, responsible for interpreting the Church's canon laws, to find out just how the Church's universal laws are framed. Despite the terrible ongoing violence in the Holy Land, hundreds of thousands of Israelis and Palestinians want peace and a future of serenity and coexistence for their families. Well, that was the message this Easter of the leader of the Catholic Church in the Holy Land, Latin Patriarch Michel Sabah of Jerusalem. In Easter liturgies over the past few feast days in Jerusalem, Patriarch Sabah criticized Israelis and Palestinians for recent bloodshed there, including Israeli military operations, rocket fire from the Gaza Strip into Israel, and a fatal shooting attack on a Jewish religious seminary. The Patriarch appealed for leaders whom he described as ready to offer their lives for the sake of peace, not leaders, he said, who issue orders to kill and assassinate. Well, as tradition holds, Patriarch Sabah celebrated Easter in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, the place where Jesus was crucified, buried, and rose from the dead. The shrine, built by the Roman Emperor Constantine in the 4th century, is the holiest for Christians the world over. It is shared by the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian Orthodox, and Catholic churches, but other communities, the Egyptian Coptic Orthodox, the Ethiopian Orthodox, and the Syrian Orthodox, also possess rights and property in or about the church. Unfortunately, disputes and rivalries have caused rifts between these Christian communities throughout these centuries. I asked Patriarch Sabah if things have changed for the better.
We had only one serious event on the time of the Anglican Orthodox Patriarch Irenaeus. On the day of the Feast of the Cross, on the 7th of May, there was a serious incident between the Greeks and the Franciscans in which the Israeli police had to interfere. But besides that, all these years the relations are rather well and good. And if there are some problems, the heads meet, which means the two patriarchs, Armenian, Greek Orthodox, and the custos of the Holy Land, they meet to resolve, to settle every problem.
Patriarch Sabah, who turned 75 on March 19th, has announced he will be retiring soon and that this would be his last Easter as Patriarch. I asked him how he will remember the challenges of the last 20 years he has led the Catholic Church in the Holy Land. He said he used a two-pronged plan of action, working to improve the pastoral life of the local Christian communities and combating injustices at a social and political level.
There was a double action, two fields, main fields of action, the pastoral one, the direct pastoral action with the parishes, and thank God it was good, rather good. We had our synod for the Catholic Church, and we have many improvements in the churches, whether in the spiritual life itself, the structures of many movements, pastoral movements, university, young movements especially, they developed well in every part of the diocese, Jordan, Israel, Palestine. And then the other field was the political life, the instability in the country, all the sufferings of the people, all this difficult search for peace and justice. This also, we were engaged in this, not in the politics themselves, but in the results and effects of these politics on the daily life of the people. From our side, the Israeli are living always in insecurity and fear. On the other side, the Palestinians, they are get killed every day with the Israeli incursions in the Palestinian towns. They have instability in politics, in economic life, and all difficulties shared by everyone, Christians and Muslims alike.
Although Patriarch Sabah finds hope in those native Christians determined to continue witnessing to Christ in his own homeland, he expresses concern that local Christians cannot access their churches freely, especially holy shrines such as the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Palestinian Christians must obtain written permits to go to Jerusalem for holy feasts, he explains, and priests and religious from Arab or other nations can wait weeks or months to obtain Israeli visas in order to work for the church in the Holy Land.
We had the problem of not having free access to Jerusalem for all our parishioners from Palestine itself or from Jordan because of security measures. We could obtain from time to time or even regularly on the main feasts, Easter and Christmas, thousands of permits, but we have to write the thousands of names as well to obtain the permits to allow people to come to Jerusalem. Then other difficulties, recent difficulties are always the question of visas is pending always. We have difficulties in obtaining visas for priests who are not resident in Israel, for example, Jordanians, Lebanese, Syrians, or others coming from abroad. They are given now one trip visa, which means that if they enter the country, they cannot leave for any circumstance. So we are trying to improve this point and this relation with the Israeli authorities, but so far it is there. So this is our remembering of the political situation, all instability, daily difficulties with the people, the emigration of some of our Christians as well because of that. But also we had the consolation to see some of our Christians wanting to remain despite all the difficulties in the Holy Land, accomplish their vocation to be Christians in the Holy Land, witnesses to Jesus in his land, not any elsewhere in the world.
Will you be remembering some things, though, with a particular joy over these last 20 years? What has brought you the most?
Well, the particular moment of joy was the year 2000 and the pilgrimage of Pope John Paul II. It was, from all aspects, a year of a kind of euphoria. Even the conflict was almost forgotten. Everything went very good for the visit of the Holy Father in Jordan, Israel, and Palestine. And it was truly a very good year, the year 2000. It was the blessing of the Jubilee, I think. But then after that, just before the end of the year, we had the Second Intifada and the beginning of more troubled situation.
Do you think that President George Bush's desire to see a final peace agreement between the Palestinians and the State of Israel, do you think that his deadline of the end of this year is possible, is attainable?
Well, what we know, what we certain of, is his will. He wants. And we know, we are certain, that Prime Minister Olmert wants peace, the same Abu Mazen. Now the question remains, whether they will be able to achieve peace. Because there are many obstacles before peace, and peace remains mainly an Israeli decision. Premier Olmert, when we met him, on a Sunday before Christmas, he told us very clearly that he is decided to break the political statu quo, that means decided for peace. But he said also there are many obstacles in Israel as well as in Palestine. So now it will depend from the power of Premier Olmert minister, if he can convince his people, the opponents, extremists, and the opponents towards peace, then we'll have peace. The peace will be an Israeli decision. The Arab world are ready. President Bush is ready. But no one can take that decision if Israel does not take it.
The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem and head of the Catholic Church in the Holy Land, Michel Sabah. More than 1 billion people today make up the Catholic Church, a worldwide faith that besides running churches, parishes, and episcopal conferences, also operates schools, seminaries, and hospitals. Just think how such a global institution could run amok if it didn't have rules and regulations to keep things running smoothly on both a doctrinal level and on an administrative level. These regulations are contained in the Code of Canon Law. The current Code of Canon Law was issued in 1983 and represents the fruit of years of hard work in the years following the Second Vatican Council. At that time, Pope John XXIII announced that he wanted the old 1917 legislative code to be revised to include the doctrinal aspects outlined during the council. Unlike the military weapon, canon in the Catholic Church means to rule or rule of law. And just as a nation's laws are divided up into articles in a code of law, the Church's legislation is divided into canons. The 1,752 canons make up the universal law of the Church and include the rights and obligations of the faithful and the clergy, rules regarding the sacraments, Catholic schools, and bishops' conferences, just to name a few. But some things, like liturgical rules and the laws governing the causes of the saints and beatifications, the Roman Curia, and the rules of the conclave, are not contained in the pages of this big, thick, red book. While the Vatican Office, responsible for interpreting these canons and ensuring that they're easily understood and up to date with the changing times, is the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, I sat down with the Council's Undersecretary, Monsignor Bernard Hebda, who told me more about the office.
We're a very small office. I suspect we're the smallest dicastery in the Holy See. So we have a president, a vice president, and a secretary. And then we have, in addition to myself, we have five canonists who work in the office. And we have a librarian. And we have some others who help us with the work as well. But because we're such a small staff, and we're international in the sense that we have one priest from Brazil, one priest from Spain, I'm from the United States. Everybody else is, of the canonists would be Italian. Of our superiors, our president's Italian, our secretary is Spanish. But because we're so small, we really rely on a body of consultors. And also the members of the council would be approximately 15 cardinals. But then it's these consultors who really give us the possibility of studying profoundly the questions that are presented to the council. They're really drawn from canonical experts around the world. Some of them would be pastors, would be bishops. Some of them would be working in tribunals. Some would be professors. We have a mix between bishops, priests, and lay people, and really globally diverse. And so if we have a question that is posed to this council, we would do some preliminary research. And then when we would have the opportunity to really understand the question, we might ask two or three consultors to offer us their opinion on the question as well. If they find that it's an area that needs to be developed or needs to be clarified, we would then convoke the members, the cardinal members. Most of the members are cardinals. We have a few who are bishops, and we have one patriarch. And then the members would really then have the opportunity to look at a question to decide whether it needs to be interpreted authentically. And that's happened relatively rarely in recent years, but it was something that was more common in the years right after 1983 when the code was promulgated.
What does interpreted authentically mean?
It's interesting. So if there's a question in the actual text of the code, if there's an ambiguity there that needs to be clarified, the code itself provides for something called authentic interpretation. And the authentic interpretation, which the Holy Father has entrusted to this pontifical council, has the same weight as the law itself. So, for example, whenever this council has issued an authentic interpretation, always with the consent of the Holy Father, who authorizes the publication of the authentic interpretation, that interpretation would have the same rank as the law itself.
You've been here over a decade.
Yes.
Have you ever had an experience of a pope coming to you, Pope John Paul perhaps, or this pope, coming and saying, I want you to look at this law, I'm not satisfied with the way it's written?
They've never come personally to our offices to do that. At the same time, there have been a number of instances where the Holy Father, usually working through the Secretary of State, has asked this council to examine either a particular canon or the way in which the canon is being applied. For example, a few years back, this council was involved in the promulgation of a document, an instruction, it's called an instruction, Dignitas Connubii, about how marriage tribunals are to proceed in annulment case, in cases of nullity of marriage. And that was something that was entrusted to this council specifically by Pope John Paul. And so there was that kind of an interest. Pope Benedict has also shown a great interest in the nuts and bolts of our work, and we're very grateful for that. In fact, we're here to serve the Holy Father, who, interestingly enough, we often think of so many other titles for the Holy Father, but he's also the legislator. And so he really is at the heart of our work.
How does the canon law within the Vatican deal with such things as theft? Do these people go to some sort of Vatican court? Is there any kind of a trial? How does the code deal with these sort of things?
Well, you're asking the wrong person, because actually it's not so much a question of canon law, but Vatican City State has its own laws. And so they also have their own courts. There's an interesting volume that the secretary of this pontifical council just put out that really collects the laws of Vatican City State. And it's fascinating to read the different areas in which there's legislation that's for anything that would happen within the Vatican itself. And so really you would want to talk to somebody that would be more involved with that, especially through the governatorato. And then there's a court of appeals. Often they might make reference to the canon law of the church, the universal law, but it's a particular law for Vatican City.
I see. And how do you work with, for example, the Roman Rota?
We wouldn't be working with them on an everyday basis. Their work is essentially judicial, whereas ours is legislative. Mm-hmm. And so obviously we want to... when there are questions that might touch on the work of the Rota, we would obviously consult them, and vice versa. The dean of the Rota, for example, is a very highly respected consultor in the work of this council. And so there have been times where we've drawn upon his insights or the insights of other Rodal auditors to help us in our work. So getting back to that instruction that I talked about before, Dignitas Conubi, it was an interesting collaboration between a number of dicasteries. And so it wasn't really just this pontifical council, even though it was directed by the president of this council, but it also would have involved the Rota and the Signatura and the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So really it's all different areas are involved in the law. But in terms of trying to understand the relationship with the Rota, I think it's best just to think about it in terms of the Rota's work being judicial, whereas ours is primarily legislative.
One of the issues which has concerned the Church in fairly recent years is the issue of the abuse by priests. Have you seen the necessity of revising canon law in order to meet these new pressing problems?
It's always been recognized as one of the most grave crimes for a priest to be involved in any way in a crime against the Sixth Commandment with somebody who is a minor. And so even in our present code, in Canon 1395, paragraph 2, the Church has set forth very clearly that that person is to receive what the Church would consider to be a just penalty, but also it could be the gravest of penalties, which would be the dismissal from the clerical state, which for a priest would be, it really reflects the fact that the Church understands this as being a very grave matter, a very grave crime. How, of course, you proceed based on this canon 1395.2 has to be developed in different ways. And obviously, we already have tribunals that function and that might be considering this canon. But there have also been subsequent documents from the Holy See that have really specified how that's to be treated. Episcopal conferences have really been at the forefront. And so, for example, the Episcopal Conference of the United States, working always in collaboration with the Holy See, promulgated a document called the Essential Norms, dealing with how those cases were to be treated in the United States. And so it would be primarily taken care of by the particular law of the place where the delict took place. Also, within the Holy See, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith has its own tribunal, and Pope John Paul provided that they would be exclusively competent to deal with those cases when they came to the level of the Holy See. And so there was, in fact, a special document for that, and both with procedural norms and substantive norms that Pope John Paul directed, really regulating the way that those cases are conducted and making sure that justice is done and that just penalties are indeed given to any priest that would have committed such a grave delict.
You said that the first code, the 1917 code, it was John the 23rd who decided by the 1960s that it was time to review that code. Does it take about every 50 years for the code to be totally reviewed? Or is this work that you're doing such that it is under continual review?
I would say the latter in some sense, in that interpretation and the possibility of authentic interpretation provides that opportunity, some flexibility in the law even before a new code would come out. And so there is always an evaluation of the canons and the opportunity to tweak the canons when there's a need to do that, always with the approval of the legislator, of course.
The legislator being the Pope.
The Holy Father, exactly. Mm-hmm. Being that we've only had two codes of canon law in the Church, the 1917 and the 1983, it's kind of hard to say what can be expected in terms of the revision of a code. Certainly it was the experience with the 1917 code that by the time they were 25 years out, they realized there were some things that needed to be clarified. Mm-hmm. And I would guess that will be the the case here as well.
What preceded the 1917 code?
There were lots and lots of laws in the church. So really from the very beginning of the church, because it had to have an institutional structure, there were always going to be norms. And so you had over history, you had certain great legal minds that tried to gather all of those different norms and to organize them. And so somebody like Gratian, for example, really put together a brilliant work organizing all of the norms that he was able to find within the purview of the church.
Back in 1917, there certainly weren't, how many did you say here?
1752
canons.
Right. There were more. So one of the ideas with the 1983 code was to really reduce some of those things, and some of the things that would have been treated in the 1917 code no longer appear in the code, but would be in separate legislations. For example, the norms concerning causes of saints. Before, there would have been some reference to that in the 1917 code. Now that's something that's completely outside of the 1983 code. But it was to make it clearer, more simple. That was the desire.
You seem to really like this job. What's your favorite part of it?
Well, to be honest with you, I enjoy working with the people in the office. We've been able to bring a great pastoral dimension to the work, because so often when you hear Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts, you just think of somebody working in a room with dusty volumes and all of these Latin texts. But I've really been blessed in working with superiors who have helped us to see that there are always people behind the questions that are presented to us. And everything that we do really is going to have an impact on the faithful. And so being able to see how some of our work has helped clarify things for some people or given them a new sense of belonging in the church has been very, very helpful, encouraging. One of the pleasant aspects of the work here in the council is really working with a broad section of canonists and also students of canon law. And so we always welcome canon law societies, for example, when they come to Rome, they're always welcome to bring their members here, and we'll talk about our work and what's going on in their country. The same with the different faculties of canon law. It's almost routine for them to come at least once a year, once every 2 years for the foreign faculties, to come and really to discuss with us what our work has been and the issues that they see as well. So that's been very positive. Our new president, Archbishop Coco Palmerio, and our new secretary, Monsignor Arrieta, Juan Ignacio Arrieta, both have wonderful reputations as scholars, and they've spoken all over the world. But the rest of us are here waiting for people to come to visit us, and we're happy to do that.
And a very warm thanks there to Monsignor Bernard Hebda, the Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.